It was late at night, and I was exhausted from a long day of sightseeing and a long evening of Guinness and merriment, catching up with my friend Connor in Dublin. I somehow managed to make it back to my hotel, and I stood at the window looking down onto the streets below from my third floor room. I was surprised to see the streets relatively empty, as it was only a little past midnight and I was on a touristy strip of bars, hotels, and hostels. Regardless, the only person I saw walking was a woman wearing a deep green dress with a gray cloak, slowly making her way down the street. She was tiny and frail and looked extremely old, but she had long, flowing red hair that seemed to blaze under the street lamps. Suddenly, the woman looked up at me, and I could see her gaunt, pale face and her bloodshot eyes and red pupils staring back up at me. I took a step back instinctively, and the woman opened her mouth, and a wail emerged that seemed to seep into my brain and was impossibly loud for someone so far away. I fell to the floor, trying to cover my ears as the wail continued on, my heart breaking from the sheer sadness of it all. I began to sob as the wail continued on without abatement, and I somehow knew, deep down in my heart, that this sound was a harbinger of sadness, and the glass of the windows began to crack. But then, I realized that I had nothing to fear, because after all, my name is Rick Kitagawa, and this is the Inner Monster Podcast. The Banshee hails from the mythology of Ireland and is a female spirit that is associated with the tumuli, or the grave mounds, that dot the Irish countryside. The Banshee, referenced first in writing in 1360, is usually described as short, both to reference her appearance as an extremely old woman, as well as referencing her fairy origins. But of course, my favorite representations is the less noted but extremely tall, monstrous spirit, mainly because it's more terrifying that way. The Banshee might be dressed in green with a gray cloak or in all white, but regardless of the account, she has long red hair and her eyes are also red from constant crying. In some parts of Ireland, it's said that her wail can shatter glass, but her cry is always the most mournful sound in the world. The Banshee's wail is said to warn of impending death or announce the death of whomever hears it, or a family member of the listener. Interestingly enough, the Banshee is only supposed to creep out those from ancient Irish heritage, which is either an interesting curse or a blessing, depending how you think about finding out that someone's gonna die. And I actually feel really bad for the Banshee, as she's trying to warn people about death, but is also perpetually sad and lonely and just wails all the time, which I imagine makes for unhappy people, and the idea of someone yelling a lot and making people unhappy made me think of ineffective leaders trying to motivate people by yelling at them. So today, instead of looking at things to strive for, we're going to look into something you should avoid: the ineffective postures of leadership. And so while I won't get into the 7 successful leadership postures that I went over in the past 2 episodes about the Garuda and the Naga, if you're looking for what you should be doing, definitely give those episodes a listen. So, I want to dive into the 4 main postures of leadership that we've been conditioned to think of as a good leader, but are actually ineffective. And I want to highlight these because, one, I think there are tons of people in leadership positions who genuinely want to become better, but have never seen a better way. And two, some of these used to actually work pre-pandemic, kind of. But now with a shift to remote and hybrid work for a good number of people, they totally break down and are now completely ineffective. And to be clear, when I said that they used to work, I would assert that they're already suboptimal options, but because they were so normalized and common, people put up with it for a lack of options. Anyway, the first anti-leadership leadership posture is that of the commander. This is your typical bro-ish, alpha male stereotype who rules the organization with an iron fist. They think of themselves as displaying confidence, competence, and believe that they are the only thing holding this sinking ship above water. Strategy behind this posture includes yelling at people in public and in private, using threats of firing people to get their way, and believing that employees don't have any other options than to work for them. Telltale signs of this beast in the wild are phrases like, "because I said so," and "you're lucky to even have this job." The commander also tends to be heard even if they can't be seen, and it often feels as if they've never heard the phrase "inside voice" while growing up. But while the commander is my personal arch nemesis, if you could have a arch nemesis in a posture, in that I really don't get along with people who take on this form of leadership, I also can empathize with them. And once again, having empathy isn't condoning, but most of the time this leader is really just unconfident in themselves and actually scared. Especially in a world that socializes toxic hypermasculinity as the ideal leadership trait, really regardless of gender, you will find people looking up to the tyrants of the world in order to get change to happen. And while this often scares people into compliance in the short term, you're also never going to see long-term improvements because when people are scared, they're not going to innovate, experiment, or stick their necks out to make things better. So while you might think that your command and conquer model is working, realistically, everyone is probably conspiring against you and some might be actively sabotaging the work. And betrayals at the most crucial time when your neck is on the line are to be expected. The next posture I want to dig into is that of the perfectionist. This one I definitely can relate to as someone who owns their own business or is a founder or has started to grow their own entrepreneurial venture of any sort. And because you have vested ownership in something, you want it to be perfect. So you have a vision in your head of what you want and you want to get there. But the problem with collaborative work is that it is collaborative, and that means a certain amount of loss of control, which means that likely it's not going to fit your imagination perfectly. The perfectionist is often well-meaning, striving for excellence out of seeking to provide those they serve with an amazing product or experience, but remember that striving for excellence does not equal perfection. After all, what's perfect for one person isn't going to be perfect for another. But really amazing can be a much more widely shared evaluation. And I know that the late Steve Jobs is often touted as being a maniac perfectionist with a large swath of the commander postures thrown in, and that he rebuilt Apple, and thanks to him we have the iPod and the iPhone. But we'll also never know the true human cost of this leadership style, to all of the health problems his team developed or exacerbated while working 80-hour weeks to quote-unquote perfect these products, which obviously still are not perfect because they're releasing new versions of the iPhone every year, and if the product truly was perfect, you wouldn't need to do that. And I personally would be fine with a less amazing phone if I also knew that the people making it were more sustainable and healthier, but that could also just be me. And typical ways that this posture of the perfectionist plays out is micromanagement and a lack of delegation, which really comes down to a trust issue around others. But often I think about the saying that if someone gives you something within 85% of what you wanted, and that 15% isn't critical, you should just go with it. The next 10% is going to cost a lot, emotionally from whoever is working for you, and it probably won't be worth that 10% increase in quote-unquote perfection. And even then, the last 5% to getting it to exactly what I wanted is probably going to eat up so many resources, trust, confidence, time, and well-being of your team that it isn't worth it. And let's get real, you're going to make improvements, patches, and new features next year anyway, so why bother with perfect? The third ineffective leadership posture I want to talk about is that of the mimic. And these people are also super well-meaning often, but can be incredibly harmful to organizations. They've read a leadership book or two, listened to podcasts about the topic, but are really kind of skimming and not internalizing the justification or strategy behind why certain tactics are useful as a leader. Like I said, mimics are incredibly dangerous to organizations because they often say the right words, and so are never going to get flagged by HR, but either change the meaning by the tone or their actions. An example is a manager saying something like, "Well, thank you for your opinion, but in order to move forward right now, let's table that for another time." Sounds all well and fine, but if this is the excuse used every week, then it becomes obvious that there never will be another time, and that they're just trying to move on without listening to people's opinions or ideas. Mimics are also probably not intentionally being horrible managers. They're obviously trying to do better, but sadly they're not investing enough emotional energy into the work to actually mean what they say. Mimics are also motivated by a fear of having difficult conversations around negative feedback, critiques of the organization, or pretty much anything that deviates from the plan. It's someone who isn't willing to put in the emotional labor to actually listen and care about the team, but is trying to use tested management techniques to avoid doing the work of being direct with others. And to be fair, I want to recognize the intention of trying to be a better manager, but the intent is almost worse than being a commander because of the sense of broken trust that comes with you saying you'll do something and then you not following through with it. But you might be asking, what does the emotional work look like in the above context? Well, it's saying we'll table that for another time, and then immediately scheduling the topic as part of the agenda for next week's meeting, and maybe even extending the time to make sure that it can be covered thoroughly. Or it's realizing that whatever the meeting was about is a directive and not up for people's feedback, and then letting people know as much via an email, so you're not wasting time for announcements that could have been done in a different medium. And if you're already made the mistake of making this the topic of the meeting, then it's addressing it right there and then and saying, "Well, you know what, that's a really interesting idea, but due to X and Y, I'll be honest, we're going to have to go with this for now, and I know this is discouraging, but here's a way Z that we can get feedback earlier next time before we bring a decision to this point." Or it's scheduling a one-on-one later to listen to the suggestion, and then immediately moving the feedback up the chain if the decision is above you. Note that there is no single right way of handling this as well, as it really depends on the context of your individual situation. But telling someone you will consider it later and then you never do is a great way to lose trust. Finally, the fourth leadership posture I'd advise you not to take is that of the confidence artist. The confidence artist is actually the name where the term con artist is derived from, as it's based on someone faking their credibility using a high amount of confidence. This is often another leader who hasn't been trained or fostered in communication and other necessary leadership skills, but is often a subject matter expert that has been promoted for their technical competency. The con artist is trying to make up for their own fear and self-doubt and inner monster raging, so they project overconfidence or arrogance and are extremely fearful of admitting they're unsure about something. This takes the form of not asking questions if something is unclear or even mocking others for asking questions. The worst case scenario is that the con artist will approve things that are flawed and then blame others later for not doing their job well enough, all in an attempt to prevent others from knowing that they have no idea what they're doing in the management space. I want to also share that I really was the epitome of all four of these craptastic leadership postures when I was younger. And to be honest, while I apologize to everyone who had to suffer because of me, I also understand that of course I was going to be a bad leader because I hadn't been taught any other way. After all, when most of the time the media shows leaders who embody the confidence artist or the commander, and when we're shown better portrayals of leaders, we end up as a mimic saying everything right, but never following through with the action part of the equation, what else could we expect? So much of the reason there are so many people adopting these ineffective leadership postures is that when you have someone in a position of power, their behavior gets modeled by others, and that becomes the culture. And when you have so much systemic cronyism, ineptitude, and arrogance baked into work, it's difficult to imagine that there are more effective ways to lead. Additionally, leading well is difficult. It's an entirely different set of skills than what helped you get to where you are. And these quote-unquote soft skills of leadership are really difficult, complex skills that require you to constantly adjust due to your individual context and relationship. It's also rewiring your brain to sit in uncertainty, embrace risk, lean into extending trust when you might not actually trust the other person, and above all, be willing to make mistakes. So if you find yourself relating to any of these negative styles of leadership, I don't want you to feel like it's the end of the world or that you should be beating yourself up. If I can move from these postures to the more effective ones, then I have full faith that you can too, if you are willing to acknowledge that what you're doing isn't working and put in the work to improve. And if you haven't listened to the Garuda or Naga episodes, those would be a great place to start. What is one behavior that you'd want to change about how you lead? And what does the first step in that direction look like? And how can you move forward today? That's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening to the Inner Monster podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to check out all of our other episodes wherever you get your podcasts or visit innermonsterpodcast.com. And if you feel so inclined, please spread the word and share this with a friend, or leave a review, or subscribe to get the podcast each week, every Inner Monster Monday. And now, a quick word from our sponsors. If you want to hear Inner Monster podcast episodes before anyone else, consider joining my Patreon at patreon.com/rickkitagawa, where you can get ad-free episodes, discounts on creepy art, and even coaching packages. That's patreon.com/rickkitagawa. I hope to see you there. Thank you so much. And I hope you have a monstrous day.